We're so blessed to have Brother Richie and Sister Richie back with us. They've been gone for years preaching up in northern Arkansas, or about 50 miles north of here. Brother Richie, we're glad you're back home where you belong. We've been studying recently about worship and what is involved in worship. We referred last week to a statement out of the Old Testament. This wasn't the text, but it was quoted, in which the psalmist spoke of his soul panting after God like a deer pants after water. And that it is that kind of worship that we wish to incorporate into our lives, being aware of the fact that we're going to become like what we worship. And so tonight I want to continue our thoughts, but I want us to advance into considering what is or who is this God. What is his nature? What is his character? What is his personality? And once discovering the personality of God, as Brother E.H. Imes says, I believe that anyone who has any capacity whatsoever for gratitude will not find it hard to love Jesus Christ. Let me share something with you that I experienced about 3 weeks ago. I was preaching a funeral in the congregation out east of us. And while sitting there waiting to speak over the body of a friend of mine's brother, I sat there and watched the flowers and the casket, and that casket and those flowers and the whole appointment of the hour was not extravagant. It was well done and appropriate. But I got to thinking about how oftentimes people are made a prey of by unscrupulous people who would sell them any number of dollars worth of casket and the finest of everything, and when people perhaps don't have the money to spend, and even if they had it, it would be an extravagance to buy something that elaborate. And I got to thinking, I doubt that Jesus would approve of extravagance in funerals. But while sitting there, I thought, well, that's true, he wouldn't. And yet, I thought, I remembered something that happened in John, the 11th chapter. Well, in John, the 12th chapter. He was sitting in the home of Simon the leper, probably. And Mary, the sister of Martha, the worshiping sister, the one whose personality was turned toward that sort of meditation, she came and, unknown to Jesus, broke a vial of perfume or ointment over his head. And this enormous amount of money was poured over the head of this man, her friend. John says the aroma filled the entire house. The disciples were indignant. They put the price of it as being 300 denarii. That's the wages of 300 days' work, a year's salary. Equivalent today, what, to $12,000, $15,000? And I thought, uh-oh, Jesus got caught in a dilemma. I don't think he would have approved of it had she asked him, Lord, can I pour this over your head? He would have said, oh, Mary, that's too much. But here she was, she didn't ask him. She just broke it and poured it over his head. Now, what was he going to do? And I realized that Jesus had gotten caught in a dilemma. The disciples were rebuking the woman. And it was extravagant. Mercy, it was extravagant. $12,000 to $15,000 equivalent to our day. She broke this thing and just poured it, and there it went. What was he going to do? Well, he could have joined in with the disciples and said, Mary, that's the most ridiculous, that's the most emotionally immature thing I've ever heard of. Why in the world didn't you save that and give it to the poor? All these poor people all around, and then you waste this on me. No, he said, leave her alone. She's done something beautiful to me. She's prepared my body for burial. But I was struck, and all this was happening while they were singing and while the people were filing in, and I was sitting there thinking about these things, and I was awestruck by the dilemma that Jesus found himself in and how he solved it. And they sang another song, and I kept thinking, I saw the sadness that always attends wedding, or funerals, not weddings, funerals, weddings too. And I saw the emotions that run high and the emotional involvement that causes people to weep and cry. There was none of that here at that particular wedding, but you've been to wedding. Just whenever I refer to it as a wedding, accept it and let's go on. You've been to funerals where that sort of thing was the order of the day. And I got to thinking, I doubt that Jesus would have approved of any extensive show of emotions as far as crying and wailing is concerned. In fact, on one occasion, he dismissed these professionals who had been hired. He just says, be away with you. Away with you. This woman isn't dead. She's just sleeping. But he fairly well dismissed them out of hand. And I don't think that Jesus would have been involved in hiring that professional band of people who brought their flutes and who made an attempt to heighten the emotional atmosphere and perhaps make it so that the people thought that this one was really and truly being mourned for. I don't think he would have approved of that. And yet, suddenly it dawned on me, I don't think he would have either. But he also got caught in another dilemma. In John, the 12th chapter, after this had happened in the 12th chapter, in John, the 11th chapter, was where he got caught in this particular dilemma. Lazarus, who was present in the 12th chapter at this feast, is recorded in the 11th chapter as having died. And Jesus was called back, not for the funeral, he was called back to heal him before he died. And he stayed a few days longer and then came back, purposefully waiting for Lazarus to die. And when he saw Mary and Martha weeping and the Jews weeping, the record says that Jesus wept. He began to cry. And I thought, well, here again, he was caught in a dilemma where probably he would not have encouraged weeping. In fact, he told Mary and Martha both, he said, I am the resurrection. Your brother will live, as though to say, don't cry. It's going to be all right. And yet, here he was crying with these people. And so I was struck by this particular quality of Jesus as he was caught in these dilemmas. And then I watched with amazement at how he dissolved them or how he solved them to where they were no longer a dilemma. He came to a conclusion about what should be done, and he did it. Now, what was it that made it a dilemma in the first place? Here was a principle of extravagance. That's no dilemma, just don't do it. But something happened. Here's the situation of an over-emotional response at a funeral. He knew better. He knew that death wasn't the end of the scene of life. And yet there was something else involved. What was the one ingredient that made these life situations a dilemma for Jesus? What was it that was inserted there, the unpredictable? What was it that was inserted in these life situations that made Jesus face a dilemma? It was people. People. Now, here is one of the most beautiful characteristics of Jesus' life. wherever people were involved, I began to sense Jesus himself made an extra effort to take the burden upon himself wherever there were people involved. Well, I went ahead and preached the funeral, and I referred to this in the funeral address. Then I got in the car and started on back home, and I began to think, you know what? This was the characteristic of his whole life. And I began to think about all the things in the life of Jesus where this holds true. One incident recorded in John the second chapter, it wasn't really very important. It didn't involve all that much of a principle, but it did in a sense. It involved his schedule. Jesus had a schedule he was following. He had one already laid out, and he had it down to where it was timed, and he knew the whole order of events and the schedule and the timing and all that was involved in it. And he was invited toward the first of his personal ministry to go to a wedding. And he got there and with his 12 disciples, and they came to the wedding, and during the course of the wedding, his mother told him, Jesus, they're out of wine. They have no more wine. She was implying, Jesus, you need to do something about it. Well, he said, dear lady, what is that to you and me? My time hasn't come yet. My hour is not here. In other words, it isn't time for me to begin showing myself in these signs and miracles. I have not planned it like this. She said to the servants, whatever he says to you, you just do it. Well, here was the situation. Here was the dilemma. The story, as we told it, was brought to the point. Jesus came to this point where there was a need. The people that were there. The host was going to be embarrassed. And yet Jesus had his schedule to maintain. He was here for the whole world. What was he going to do about a bride and a bridegroom and a host in some little town, Cana of Galilee? What was he going to do? Well, he just, in a sense, got out his paper and pencil and figured out he rearranged his schedule. That's all you can say about it. Why? Well, because people were involved. He didn't want to embarrass the person who was there. He had the power and he had the presence of mind. He had it if he wanted to use it. He could have saved that person that embarrassment. So he did. Because people were involved. Look again. You remember when he was on his way up to Jerusalem from his last hiding place, was passing through the city of Jericho. And there was a man there who became aware of the fact that Jesus of Nazareth was coming through the city that day. There was going to be a parade. There was a whole host of people, a multitude, coming through town. And Zacchaeus saw it. And he knew that it was Jesus, and it was told that it was Jesus that was coming, but he couldn't see him. People had lined up on the streets, no doubt, and he couldn't see over their shoulders. And so he looked on down the street and saw this sycamore tree and ran up and got up in that sycamore tree and got him a box seat. And here came Jesus. Now this incident here shows that something else was at stake. Now, if you don't see anything that's at stake, you don't understand publicans. You don't understand tax collectors. These men were thieves. They were men who were extortioners. They were practicing legalized theft. The government of the Roman Empire had entrusted into these men's hands the task of collecting taxes from the Jewish people. And they were considered as traitors. They were considered as traitors and as thieves and as sinners and social outcasts. Now, in this incident, then Jesus' reputation was at stake. And so he came to the tree, and there were several alternatives, at least two or three. Number one, he could have ignored this man Zacchaeus. Like we do many times, people who are problems, we just don't like to, let's just not get involved. He could have ignored him. There was a large crowd and people were talking, you know, and maybe shouting and laughing. And he could have just ignored this man sitting up there in the tree. He could have solved it like that. Then there wouldn't have been any more dilemma. Just ignore him and maybe it'll go away. Or he could have stopped and used this man as an opportunity to let the entire Jewish nation know for sure that Jesus of Nazareth does not put up with and does not in any sense endorse extortion or stealing or the kind of life that this man was living in regard to the taxes of other people. Oh, here was a prime opportunity. He had him up in the tree. He could have skinned him. He could have said, Zacchaeus, you low-down scoundrel, you've been stealing from these people. He could read his mind. He knew his books. He knew everything about this man. He could have let him have it. And there Zacchaeus was up in the tree. There wasn't a better opportunity in the world for Jesus to let it be known, I don't stand for thievery. Well, what was he going to do? Here was a dilemma. What was the other opportunity? The other opportunity or the other option was, he said, Zacchaeus, come on down. I'm going home with you. Going home with you? People said, look, he's going home with a man that's a sinner. And his reputation really was at stake. But watch how he solved it. The solution was that when he went home with this man and the man was so thrilled, he called all of his old cronies, all of his old buddies. He got them all in there and says he made him this huge feast. And Zacchaeus was there. Jesus was there. Jesus was there with these thieves, these people who had stolen from the Jewish people. What in the world is he thinking about? Oh, he was thinking about Zacchaeus' soul, thinking about Zacchaeus. And sure enough, Jesus had him pegged right, because during the middle of the feast, Zacchaeus stood up and said, Lord, I'm going to give half of what I've got to the poor. And if I've stolen anything from anybody, I'm going to restore it fourfold. Jesus said, Zacchaeus, today salvation has come to this house. And he told all the people there, this man is a son of Abraham too, you know. So that was the way he solved that dilemma. The dilemma was, what was he going to do? His reputation for standing against wrong, for standing against thievery, he was thrown into this dilemma. He could have solved it by just scaling the man. He could have solved it by ignoring the man. But not Jesus. There were people involved, you see. So he called him down and went home with him and accomplished all of this too, you see. Well, there's another occasion. And that's in the book of John again. In chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, where this woman was taken in adultery. And you know the story. And this was thrown upon Jesus. He couldn't ignore this one. This dilemma was thrown upon him. It was thrust upon him by the Pharisees, the rulers of the Jews. They brought him to this. They brought her to this man, Jesus, and he was sitting there in the temple teaching. And there was this large throng of people, maybe a couple of thousand, I don't know. And they threw her into the midst and said, this woman we found in the act of adultery. Now the law says, kill her. What do you say? Oh, what a dilemma. What was at stake here? What was at stake here was the upholding of the law of Moses. That's what was at stake. And whether or not Jesus would be recognized as a person who would stand fourfold and foursquare on the law. You're going to uphold the law of Jesus or are you going to let it go? What a dilemma. Well, he could have solved it. He could have said, you're right, the law says that. Let's go stone her. He could have said, all right, let's those of among us who are without sin cast the first stone. And that would have qualified him to stone her. But he stooped down and began to doodle in the sand. They thought they had him. Boy, they sensed victory. They thought, well, how about it? We finally caught him. And they began, no doubt, to nudge each other and say, get him again. And so they said, what about it? What are you going to do about this? And so he raised up then and said, well, let him that's without sin among you cast the first stone. And you know the story. Beautiful. they began to just kind of disappear back into the cracks. And then he said, "Dear lady, where are your accusers?" She said, "I have none, Lord." He said, "Then neither do I condemn you. Go your way now and don't you sin anymore." What was the dilemma? The dilemma was, are you going to uphold righteousness or not? Well, that was simple. Just kill her. That would have taught them the lesson. Yeah, except for one problem. There was a people involved. And I've learned in studying the life of this great man that wherever there were people involved, Jesus did whatever was necessary to take the burden on himself. And I think it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. But now watch a larger scale. These are incidents isolated in the life of Jesus. They are characteristic of the life of Jesus. But then a broader picture becomes visible to us. This quality of God taking upon himself the burden of the sins of men, that has a broader context, you see, than just individual instances. That's the whole character of the scheme of redemption. Here, God was faced with another dilemma. He had made man, and the story up to this point was in the Garden of Eden. He made man in his own image. He gave him dominion over all the earth. He gave him dominion over all the things that were in the sea. He made him like himself. He gave him the power of choice between good and evil. He made him as a responsive human being, not as a robot. And yet, all of a sudden, here it is. Man sinned. He blew it. Well, the Bible teaches us that God's attitude towards sin is this: the soul that sins, it shall die. Ezekiel, the 18th chapter, and verse 4. Well, that's simple enough then. Just kill them. Wipe them off the face of the earth. Oh, that's easy enough said. With only one problem. There were some people involved. God just couldn't bring himself to do it. Listen to this dilemma as it's pointed out in the book of Hosea. In chapter 11, listen to this statement, and it's several verses. And listen to the tenderness of it, and you'll sense the dilemma. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to Baals and burning incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms, but they didn't know that I healed them. I led them with cords of compassion, with the bands of love. And I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and fed them. They shall return to the land of Egypt, and Assyria shall be their king, because they've refused to return to me. The sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them in their fortresses. My people are bent on turning away from me, so they are appointed to the yoke, and none shall remove it. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my fierce anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim. For I am God, not man, the Holy One in your midst. And I will not come to destroy. You see the struggle that he went through? As he looked down and saw his unfaithful people, he says, what am I going to do with you? I've brought you up. I taught you how to walk. I picked you up and carried you in my arms. I stooped down and fed you. I nursed you. I healed you. And here you are bent on leaving me. What am I going to do? I can't give you up. I can't treat you like that. I can't do it. My heart won't allow me. So the Old Testament, in a sense, closed, as far as the Jewish people were concerned, with this question still unanswered. And yet the answer was given, but they just didn't see it. In Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, there's the answer. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that made us whole, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that's led to the slaughter, and a sheep before its shearers is dumb, so opened he not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due? And they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When he makes himself an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. You see the dilemma of God? You see how in man's overall, the overall history of the human race, God looked down and said, how can I give you up? How can I punish you? How can I mete out the same judgment to you that ought to be meted out to everybody that sins? How can I do it? Then he says, I won't do it. I'll figure out a way to get you around it. I'll do it myself. I'll take it upon me. And so he did. And they led him up to Golgotha, and they put him to death. And so we see, you see, who this God is. Who in the world is this God that we're supposed to be worshiping? He's the God who, whenever and wherever people are involved, he just simply works overtime to see to it that he takes the burden upon himself. To me, that's one of the most beautiful awarenesses that I've ever discovered. There's another step, and I'm going to leave this thought with you. In this evidence that I've presented tonight, that in the life of Jesus, and that in the overall plan of the whole scheme of redemption, this is another example of what we call self-corroborative evidence. Now listen, and don't miss this point, please. Self-corroborative evidence. You know, the scheme sounds very grand. It sounds very noble. The God of the universe predicting out of the Old Testament, I'll take their burden upon myself. I'll take their struggle. I'll see to it. You won't have to bear your burden. I'm going to take it upon me. And it's very, very grand to see that here's a man on the cross that claims to be this God in the Old Testament who made this promise. I'm going to take your sins upon me and I'll take care of it. And the cross is very grandiose. It's very, very noble. But what if that man who died on the cross had, during his lifetime, not shown any of this characteristic at all while he was living? What if when he was confronted with the dilemma in John 2 and looked at his schedule and says, nope, that's your problem, baby. You were the one that should have had the wine here. I'm not about to come and do anything about it. That's your red wagon. You pull it. And we read that. You mean that's part of the... Or when we find him coming in front of Zacchaeus, you know, and this man sitting up there in the tree, this thief, this legalized robber, standing up there or sitting in the tree, and Jesus comes by and he knows who he is. And he says to him, you low-down sneak thief, you dare take the people's money like you've taken it and make your bed easy and make your nest feathered like that? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. And then just reduce that man to ashes right there up in front of everybody's eyes. It didn't happen like that. Or when the woman is taken in adultery and brought there, he says, fine thing you've done. Well, baby, you've made your own bed. You lie in it. That's your problem. Don't get on me. Look here, I haven't got time to fool with that. I want people to know that I'm standing up for the law. What if we had found somebody who every time when there was a dilemma involved, where every time his schedule was involved, or his reputation was involved, or the law was involved, what if you found him saying, essentially, well, you don't really matter. Then I would have been one, I think, eventually to have seen through it, and I would have said, well, I'm sorry. He's not the one that God said he would be. He's not the Messiah. But aren't you thankful that that's not the picture we get? The picture we get is the one we've seen tonight of this man who, whenever people were involved, even when his own schedule was at stake, when his own reputation was at stake, when the very law of God was at stake, this man said, well, I'll figure out a way. And he essentially just simply laid his life down and said, if you're going to kill them, you're going to have to kill me too. And we see it enacted on the very cross itself. When the very last thing that he did practically, hanging there between these two thieves, accomplishing what we know of as the grand scheme of redemption that spans from one end of the age to the other, which really in effect leaves all of us kind of, it leaves us not knowing, it leaves us untouched in a sense. You can't grasp it, I can't either. But then he gave us this gentle illustration of what he was doing. When this unknown thief, we don't even know his name, don't know where he's from, don't know his mom and dad's name, don't know what he stole, don't know when he stole it, don't know how long he'd been in jail, don't know how much he had stole or what it was worth. We don't know anything. When he said, Jesus, would you remember me when you come in your kingdom? We find this man, in a sense, interrupting now what he was doing. Why? Because there was a people involved. There was an unknown thief involved. So he just reached down and said, today, you're going to be with me in paradise. And there's the message of the gospel. There's the illustration of the cross. That's what it's all about. And so we see confirmed then in the life of Jesus Christ the very overall message of the scheme of redemption. And we see it all wrapped up in this one man's life. And that's the God that we're to worship. The God who, when it involves people, simply works overtime. He figures out a way to take the burden upon himself. That's who it is. Would you like to serve him? Listen, you're going to serve somebody. You're going to serve something. You're either going to serve your passions, or you're going to serve fame, or you're going to serve public approval, or you're going to serve money. You're going to serve some kind of a God. And every last one of them is going to turn on you in the end. And when you're too old to be able to deserve the fame in the sense that you can't dribble anymore if you're a basketball player and all the applause, that's not going to amount to a hill of beans. And when you're too old for the money to mean anything and you've lost that, when you're too old or when you're too decrepit or when you're too whatever, what's going to happen then? When your passions are no longer with you, when your ability to satisfy them has gone, what's going to happen then? You're going to serve something. You're not your own man. Someone is going to rule over you. I want this God to rule over me. The God who, when I look for him, I always find him down there washing my feet. He's the God who, when people are involved, makes a way to take the burden on himself. If you want to serve him tonight, come in faith. Let's immerse you in water upon the confession of your faith. And then let's be raised to walk a new life and spend the rest of your life worshiping him. Will you come while we stand and sing?